stick-up version of that hymn was around when this lady was about, I'm sure she would have been singing that. The story we read this morning from John chapter 8. Just again, looking into these verses. Firstly, let me tell you about this man. His name is Daniel Webster. What stands out to you about this man, Daniel Webster? When you look at it, there's a feature about this man. What is that? Look at his eyes. Look at his eyebrows. Fantastic set of eyebrows he has. Now, who is he? Well, who was he? Well, Daniel Webster served as a congressman and secretary of state for 3 presidents in America in the mid-1800s. He was very responsible for healing and developing a very close and good working relationship with Great Britain at the time. But before going into politics, he was a well-known and a very successful lawyer. And as I said, he has such an outstanding and imposing figure. And Daniel Webster was an imposing figure in the courtroom. It is said on one occasion, he stared a witness out of the court. Webster knew the man was there to deliver a false testimony. So he fixed his dark, thick-browed eyes on the man and searched him. And according to the story, later in the trial, Webster again looked around the courtroom to see if his witness was ready to go into the witness box and cross-examination. And the witness felt so uneasy in his seat. He reached for his hat. He started to work along the bench seat, getting closer and closer to the door. And when the third time Webster looked on him, the witness could sit there no longer. And he dashed out the door, ran down the road, and he was never seen again. It was as if Webster could see right through him. It was as Webster knew this witness was there, and he'd been told what to do, what to say. And with his penetrating gaze, Webster gave this man the opportunity to examine himself, to reconsider his mission, and to make his getaway. And we find a similar story in these verses we read in John chapter 8, 1 to 11. We look at the setting in those first 2 verses. John tells us that Jesus went to the Mount of Olives the night before, probably stayed at the home of Mary and Martha at Bethany. They lived a mile or so from Jerusalem. And Jesus often stayed with them when he was attending one of the feasts in Jerusalem. The next morning we find Jesus back in the temple. Verse 2 says, early in the morning he came into the temple. All the people were coming to him. He sat down and began to teach them. A crowd was gathering around Jesus. He sat down to teach. This was the usual practice of those rabbis. They taught from a sitting position. They could have been sat on the steps. They could have often were provided with a little stool to sit on as they taught the crowd. Secondly, we see the confrontation, verses 3 to 6. Jesus is just beginning to teach the people, and he is rudely interrupted. Verse 3 says, the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery and have had her stand in their midst. Now, what were they up to? Whatever it is, they wanted the whole crowd to watch. They wanted the whole crowd to listen what happens next. On the previous day, the multitude was disputing whether Jesus was the prophet or the Messiah. The temple officers were so amazed at Jesus' teaching, they didn't arrest him. And all the sarcastic remarks directed at the multitude by the leaders accomplished nothing. The people were all assembled again. They were eager to hear what Jesus had to say. We ask the question, have the scribes and the Pharisees now come up with a better idea? Let's see what they say. In verse 4 and 5, we read, they said to him, teacher, This woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. What then do you say? By asking that question, the scribe and the Pharisees had broken their own laws, which stated such cases were to be handled by their own court. They were also lying to the crowd by giving them the impression that they come to seek an expert's opinion on this matter. Also, does this statement sound suspicious to you? Wouldn't you say it's very unusual to stumble across adultery taking place? It's usually done in secret. This is not the kind of offence that can be committed by one person alone. We have the lady there, where's the man? Was no attempt made to arrest him? He was just as guilty under the law as the woman. Did they let him go? Is he now one of those men who is now standing before Jesus? By their statement, by their question, they put Jesus in a dilemma. A dilemma is defined as a choice between two equal alternatives. In this case, both of his options are equally dangerous. If Jesus agreed with the law and told them to stone her, he would be disobeying the Roman government, which had jurisdiction over such cases. And Jesus would be dragged before a Roman court. The Jews would distort his claims of kingship. They would probably have him executed as one who is an insurrectionist. On the other hand, if Jesus refused to allow the woman to be stoned, he would be disobeying the law of Moses, and so contradicting his claim to be the Messiah. The crowd around Jesus would be witnesses to his disobedience. The word would spread fast. That would soon be the end of his authority as a teacher. The beginning of verse 6 tells us their motive. It says, and they were saying this, testing him, in order that they might have grounds to accuse him. It was a well-laid trap. I can picture the smile on the faces of these scribes and Pharisees, a glint in their eyes as they waited for Jesus to fall into their snare. They were hoping to bring Jesus before Pilate, before the Roman governor, even that very day. Then we see Jesus' response to his questioners, verses 6 to 8. What happens next must have startled them. It must have confused them. At the end of verse 6 it says, but Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground. Try to put yourself in that scene. Jesus is sitting on the steps or on the stool. The scribes and the Pharisees have asked him a difficult question. Immediately Jesus takes his eyes off them, bends down to the ground and starts writing with his finger in the dust. Do you have a picture of that scene in your mind? Can you imagine the scribes and the Pharisees, what they must have been thinking? What they must be saying to one another as they see this take place? Is he crazy? Is he stalling? Is he trying to come up with an answer? Verse 7 begins with the words, they persisted in asking him. Jesus wasn't responding to them, and they were getting more and more urgent, asking for an answer. But Jesus hasn't stopped what he is doing. He hasn't looked up to them yet, despite their requests. The scribes and the Pharisees are getting louder as they demand an answer. And meanwhile, the woman and the crowd are watching, listening in silence. When is this going to end? And finally, during all that noise and confusion, we read he, that's Jesus, straightened up. And like this man, Daniel Webster, in my introduction, he looked at each one of those men with his penetrating gaze, searching their very souls. And there was silence once again. And Jesus says, he who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And as he said those words, I believe Jesus looked at each one of those men again. And the eyes of some of those began to be lowered. They didn't want to look at him. They didn't want to face him eye to eye. They were facing guilt. They were experiencing guilt. I wonder by his words, did Jesus mean, let him who is perfect cast the first stone? I don't think it was necessarily that's what Jesus was saying. I believe he was referring to the sin specifically of adultery. We remember in Matthew 5, during the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus defined adultery in accordance with God's perfect standard. And Jesus was saying, anyone who has not committed this sin of adultery at some time himself, or anyone who has not desired to do so and would have done so if they could have got away with it, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And then we have that old age debate. What was the Lord writing in the dust on the ground? Was he writing the commandments? Some of the commentators say he probably was writing the Ten Commandments. Was he writing down the sins of those who were the accusers of this woman? There are many possibilities and we don't know. The information wasn't given to us by the Apostle John. Maybe it's because we don't need to know what Jesus was writing. It's the very act of God, the Son, writing with his finger in the dust on the ground. Can you think of an occasion in the Old Testament when we read of God writing with his finger? Exodus 31 verse 18, when he, as God, had finished speaking with Moses upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses two tablets of stone, written by the finger of God. Was this Jesus' intent to focus the attention on the act of writing? Jesus once again claiming to be God, the one who wrote the commandments on the stone with his finger for Moses and the people of Israel. That's my thinking, and the reasons is because what happens later in this story. After saying those words to the scribes and the Pharisees in verse 8, we read again, Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground. And you can imagine those scribes and those Pharisees again thinking, he's doing it again. Then we ask ourselves, what's the significance of that? And if those enemies of Jesus didn't get it the first time, did they catch on the second time? I don't think Jesus was repeating his actions for the sake of repeating his actions. He's reminding the audience of the events that happened after God gave the commandments to Moses. There's more to that story. There's more to this story as Jesus writes with his finger again. Let's look at what those accusers were thinking. When Moses came down from the mountain with those two tablets of stone with the law, he saw the people of Israel worshipping a golden calf, engaging in sexual immorality. And Exodus 32 verse 6 tells us the people sat down to eat, drink and rose up to play. In anger, Moses threw the tablets of stone from his hands and shattered them. As the woman's accusers watched Jesus write on the ground a second time, they are reminded that God showed mercy on his people, that God forgave their sin, that God wrote the law on the tablets of stone with his finger a second time. And we come to verse 9, we have the walk of shame. A movement is taking place among those women's accusers. Verse 9 says, and when they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones, and he was left alone, and the woman, where she had been, in their midst. Just now it had been a commotion and noise as the officials there persisted and begged Jesus to give an answer. Jesus replies and it goes quiet, very quiet. And all you could hear is a thud, 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 As each one of those accusers dropped the stone they had in their hand and walked away. Those who accused the woman became convicted of her own sinfulness. They began to go away one by one. We read the older men probably had the guilt of their sin gnawing at them the longest, and they were first to leave. It was a long walk of shame through the temple to their homes. I can imagine they didn't want anyone to see them. They didn't want to meet anyone in public for the rest of that day. Their perfect plan had backfired. They were caught up in remembrance of their own sins. As we study verse 9, it's important to know that there's a difference between guilt and shame. In this case, the scribes and the Pharisees were experiencing both emotions. They felt guilt inside because of the thing they had done. They felt shame because all the people were watching them. Their guilt made them speechless. Their shame, and in their shame, they wanted to get away from the crowd and be alone. Then we have the words to the woman in verses 10 and 11. The accusers are gone. Jesus is looking at the woman. Meanwhile, the crowd is standing there, quietly anxious to see and hear what Jesus is going to say and do next. Verse 10 says, straightening up, Jesus said to her, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" The word condemn refers to an outward punishment, not an inward guilt. He's saying to her, has no one shown himself qualified or ready to begin the stoning? Jesus is asking her questions to focus her thoughts upon what just happened. Jesus is trying to get a response from her as she stands before him in awe and wide-eyed amazement. And her response to him is, "No one, Lord." There's no clear indication that this woman was a follower of Jesus, nor is there one that at that moment that she became one. But I'm sure she was grateful to him for what he had done for her. She made no excuse for her conduct. And Jesus ends the conversation with these words, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. From now on, sin no more." Jesus forgave her. He didn't condone her sin, but he forgave her. He didn't say sin as little as possible, but sin no more. There's a man called Warren Wiersbe who's wrote many books, preached many sermons, and he makes this comment about this verse in Scripture. We must not misinterpret this event to mean that Jesus was easy on sin, or that he contradicted the law. For Jesus to forgive this woman meant that he had to one day die for her and die for her sins. Forgiveness is free, but it's not cheap. And the woman, she left the assembly with forgiveness. She was released from the conviction and guilt of her past sins and the desire to live according to God's law. She was also left with a clear understanding of Jesus Christ, the choice of following him. So briefly, what conclusions can we get from this story? There are several things we can learn, several things we can apply to our own lives from this passage of Scripture. There's a principle here to guide us when we're dealing with sin in the life of another believer. It's wrong to approach a believer concerning a particular sin in his or her life if that same sin has not been dealt with in our own lives. Confronting wrong calls us to humility, not pride. Paul says in Galatians 6, verse 1, "Even if a man is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Each one looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted." As the saying goes, "There but for the grace of God go you and I." Correcting wrongs in another's life begins with forgiveness. Jesus said to this woman, "Neither do I condemn you," before saying, "Sin no more." Let's look upon others not based on their past, but based on their future. Let's also look to ourselves the way God sees us. We are guilty of sin. Whether we've been caught or not, we are still guilty of sin. We learn that Jesus hates and condemns the sin, but he loves the sinner. He forgives. He accepts all who come to him in faith and repentant hearts. Question I leave with you this morning. Do you know the joy of sin forgiving? Let's sing our final hymn.